Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 14th of January 2018. My name's DRP Watson, and this time I'm joined by Gareth James and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about Belleville at the Donmar Warehouse. This is a play by the writer Amy Herzog, directed by Michael Longhurst, with a design by Tom Scutt. It stars James Norton, Imogen Poots, Faith Alabi, and Malachi Kirby. It's about a young American couple who are living in Paris and living the Parisian dream that Americans often have. They are renting a flat, an apartment, from a Muslim couple who are immigrants, and they own a shop as well as a number of other businesses. The man, Zach, is a doctor, apparently working at a prestigious international medical agency like Médecins Sans Frontières or World Health Organization body. His wife, Abby, seems to suffer from some problems for herself. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
I thought it was a very good play. It's actually Amy Herzog's debut in the UK. She's written a number of plays, but this is the first I think we've had here. And as you say, it concerns this young paediatrician, newly qualified, and his wife Abby, who come to live in Paris. And it all starts very plausibly. You know, it's quite plausible, I guess, that an American paediatrician might be recruited by a research institute in Paris and come over with his wife. And his wife doesn't speak French, which means she can't work, but she does give some yoga classes, I think it is, and she gives up her French classes, so she's not even trying. At first, you sort of think she is quite high maintenance. She's, I mean, at worst neurotic, at best perhaps paranoid, so she's quite a handful as a character. And at first you think that, in a way, the play is about her and the issues that she has. You know, she contacts her father and sister regularly every day back in the US. Her sister's pregnant back home. Her dad was widowed before they came out. And you think it's really all about Abby. And then the play turns quite dramatically. And Zach's truth begins to unravel. And then it's all kind of secrets and lies towards what's quite a tragic conclusion, really. I thought the characters were very well drawn, and I thought that it was quite a plausible relationship and indeed a plausible situation. Although some, I think, find its twist a little melodramatic. I didn't think that myself. I like the way the play surprises you because it does often go down paths you just weren't expecting. And I felt it kept on the right side of melodrama. There's a lot of tension in Michael Longhurst's production, which I thought was aided a lot by the soundscape that they use. Ben and Max Wingham, who are known for these things, have given it a soundscape. And it actually sort of gripped me. It's an hour and 40 minutes without an interval, and it actually gripped me for the whole of that time. And I felt that, you know, the fact it was plausible and realistic and the fact that Tom Stuckert's design is a kind of bohemian garret is quite claustrophobic added. And it kind of unfolded for me a bit like a thriller, really. I would add to that the fact that it's really very, very well performed. I first saw Imogen Poots, which I think was her stage debut last year, in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and I was really impressed by that. I'm even more impressed here by her characterization of Abby, you know, as a very fragile, highly strung, very vulnerable character. And James Norton, I think, is also hugely impressive. He's a very edgy sort of Zach, and he has to transition from a sort of protective husband to a more controlling character in the blink of an eye, really. It's difficult for Malachi Kirby and Faith Alabi because, in comparison, their roles are relatively underwritten. And they, interestingly enough, communicate mostly in French and in the final scene almost entirely in French. But somehow you still, even if you don't speak the language, you still do comprehend what's happening. I'd been banging on about 2017 being a great year for new plays, and I started the new year with this new play. So I think it's a very good start of the new year, really. So I think one I would recommend if it's possible to get to see it, if it's still on.
I wasn't quite as impressed with this as you were. Unfortunately, you know, nothing to do with the acting, which I thought was perfectly sound. I did think the Muslim couple were a bit underwritten, perhaps like you. My major problem with this was that I didn't give a damn about the two main characters. I really didn't care for them at all. I wasn't interested in them. I couldn't empathize with them. I didn't care about them. I mean, you know, some pretty nasty things happened to them, but I just couldn't make myself care about these two people. I mean, there's something about them that was fundamentally uninteresting about everything they did. You know, okay, there is this big dramatic story, which I sussed sort of about half an hour in, because I thought that that's likely what was going to happen. But in the end, I didn't care. I mean, terrible things happened to this couple, and in some ways it's very, very tragic, but I just wasn't interested in them. And it's a rather bad thing to say, I know, because you should be, but I there's something about them I just didn't care. I just wasn't interested. And obviously it's not to do with the overall story, because the overall story is quite interesting if you map it all out and with the twist and everything like that. But there was just something, there was just something I didn't like about them. Didn't make me, really care about them. And it's not because, I hate Americans or anything like that. It was, I can't put my finger on it. I'm struggling to come up with words other than I just didn't care about these two people living in their flat and living in their fairly... It felt like a fairly selfish existence a lot of the time, and you could tell they were broken people, but they weren't broken in a way that... I don't know that it was ever really explained why they were broken, and perhaps not enough of who they were before they came here, other than a certain amount of sort of mental disturbance in one of the characters, and the idea of breakdowns and diseases. But there's nothing, nothing really pushing them forward and guiding them, and no sense that I didn't feel there was enough background there to really make me care about them. And it made it a problem, because I was watching, what I could see was a well put together play in most ways, in terms of they're getting the dialogue right, it feels natural, they feel natural together, and all that, and I could see that the performances were very good, but I really just didn't care about the characters, and that's a big problem when you come to watch the play. And I found myself rather more interested in the Muslim couple, who are in some ways victims of this American couple, I mean, in as well as being their landlords. So I came away a little bit disappointed from this play, because I just didn't get it, and that can be a problem. I mean, I know I'm probably the only person, because I saw all sorts of very good reviews for this. I don't think anybody's really complained or really given it a bad review. And maybe my empathy just disappeared, and I'm not sure how to explain it other than that. But yeah, I found it rather disappointing in that sense.
But surely you often go to the theatre and don't like a character. I mean, you don't have to like a character to enjoy a play. I mean, you go and see evil men as characters in the theatre. You go and see sort of rapists and murderers, and you don't necessarily like them, but it doesn't mean you don't get something out of the play. I actually thought the Senegalese couple, I think what was interesting is that because they're effectively the landlord and they're successful business people and they have children, in a way it was quite an interesting sort of spin to make the dysfunctional characters the ones that you might have expected to be the successful characters, if you see what I mean. So I thought that was actually quite a clever spin, but I didn't like them, but I still enjoyed the play.
It's difficult to explain. It wasn't that I didn't like them so much as not caring about them. It's just you're not interested enough, and that was the problem. It was just, I was finding it very, very odd that I was thinking, well, I should be interested in these people. They, they got flaws, and I just wasn't. And maybe it was just the night I went, just the way I was feeling. I mean, of course, you see evil people, but you become interested in them, and you see good people, and you become interested in them at the theatre. And I just was not interested in this couple, and I don't know why. I can't put my finger on why I wasn't interested, but I just wasn't. We're now going to talk about the Romans season at the Barbican Theatre. This is presented by the RSC. They have put on Shakespeare's four main Roman plays, that is Coriolanus, Julius Caesar, Antony and Cleopatra, and Titus Andronicus. Coriolanus, the general who is a bit too vicious for the likes of the Romans, they think he's going to turn into a dictator, and they get rid of him, and then he joins up with his enemies. We have Julius Caesar, which is partially about Julius Caesar, although he dies rather quickly, and then we get the story of really of two of the conspirators, Cassius and Brutus, who suffer the problems of Octavian and Mark Antony. And then we get Antony Cleopatra, which picks up the story of Octavian and Mark Antony and includes Mark Antony's affair with Cleopatra. And finally, Titus Andronicus, which is set towards the end of the Roman Empire, I tend to think, because we're talking about the Goths. Goths didn't start invading until sort of 400 AD or something like that, or, you know, around about the 4th or 5th century. So this is a story from the later Roman Empire, where we have Titus Andronicus and his 50 sons, he feels sorry for the mother, wife or wives, actually, and they all get slowly whittled down to until you haven't got any left, and terrible things happen to his daughter, and he takes revenge on the family. The Roman Emperor and his Goth wife who commit these crimes, or help commit these crimes. They share a similar design look, although most of them are slightly differently designed. We have the designer Robert Innes Hopkins does, I think, all of the design for these plays. We also get a slight variation in the music, and we also get different directors. In the case of Anthony Cleopatra, it's Iqbal Khan. For Julius Caesar, it was Angus Jackson. And for Titus Andronicus, it's Blanche McIntyre, and I believe Douglas Jackson also directed Coriolanus. Coriolanus had Sopo Dirisu as Coriolanus, and we also had Hayden Gwynne as Volumnia, his mother, and Paul Jessen as the patrician, whose name I forget, but the patrician who does the famous belly speech, which is, of course, an example of trickle-down economics. In Julius Caesar is played by Andrew Woodall, and Brutus is played by Alex Waldman, and Cassius is played by Martin Hudson. For Antony and Cleopatra, both Antony and Octavian are played by different people in this play. Mark Antony is played by Anthony Byrne, and we have Joseph Simon playing Cleopatra. For Titus Andronicus, really the part here is the return of David Troughton to play Titus. David Troughton, for about 20 years, I was seeing him regularly in pretty much everything at the RSC, including a really, you know, he played really great Caliban and Macbeth and lots of other great characters, and it's nice to see him sort of back at the RSC, because he really is an interesting, a fascinating actor, I think, and one of the really good ones. I mean, we do have some very good performances. I mean, certainly seeing Joseph Simon as a really good Cleopatra. So, Gareth, what did you think generally of this season of plays?
I think I enjoyed the season overall. I went to see all four plays. The order I saw them in was Coriolanus, followed by Titus, followed by Antony and Cleopatra, followed by Julius Caesar. And it was the latter two I enjoyed most. The Titus and the Coriolanus I had a few problems with. The two that resonated most in terms of timing, I thought, were Coriolanus and Julius Caesar. One of the reasons I preferred Antony Cleopatra and Julius Caesar was because this basic design that Robert Innes Hopkins has put in those two plays did the costuming and the sort of the limited number of props in a very classical sense. So, you know, they were in that way fairly sort of conventional Shakespeare productions. I didn't really think the modernization of the other two plays worked that well. I mean, in Coriolanus, you know, you start off with things like forklift trucks on stage and metal roller doors, and there was a sort of modern grayness about it that just didn't work for me, really. And in Titus Andronicus, it was the gimmicks as well as the modernity of the production that didn't work for me either, really. I just felt there were too many of them. I mean, I'm not against modern productions. Indeed, I've seen a lot of modern productions I've raved about. But in this particular case, I didn't think that they worked. And in the Titus Andronicus, for example, I mean, she's trying to draw a parallel between, you know, the end of the Roman Empire and the state of the Western world today, which I, you know, just didn't work at all for me, really. I also saw the Imperium plays up at Stratford in the same time span that I saw these plays. It was sort of after the first and before the next three, I think. And those plays represent a similar timeline to Julius Caesar and Antony and Cleopatra, but from a different perspective, i.e. from Cicero's perspective. And they're modern, you know, it's modern writing rather than Shakespeare. And I benefited a lot, I felt, from seeing those at the same time, because I felt that I was really being immersed in this huge chunk of Roman history. And the parallels that come through in Julius Caesar are just quite extraordinary, really. I mean, you know, what we're dealing with in Julius Caesar is we're dealing with a people that will basically follow anyone who pushes the right buttons. And, you know, if they set out their belief, they engage emotionally, and then they lay out their supporting facts. Well, the only difference between that and what we're seeing now is that it's supporting lies rather than supporting facts. People switch allegiances very quickly, Julius Caesar, which I think we're seeing happening today now. I think what we also see is that, you know, when power goes to people's heads or when they derail, the leaders are actually dealt with by their own. I think we've sort of, you know, we've seen that in recent history as well. And, you know, when you think you've got rid of a tyrant, another tyrant turns up, really. And I was kind of, you know, that echoed with Arab Spring for me, really. So I just felt that Julius Caesar and Coriolanus, because he's a man who can't engage with the public, you know, he's a leader, but he's a leader who cannot engage with the public. I thought that was an interesting parallel as well. So I thought that was perhaps the design and the conventionality of the performances and the material probably helped. As far as performances are concerned, I thought there were some great performances throughout the whole thing. I mean, the Coriolanus of Sope Dirisu, I thought, was outstanding. I thought that it was great, as you said, to see David Triton back as Titus Andronicus. And I've seen some pretty amazing Antony and Cleopatras, really. And I thought that these two really came off very well against that. Joseph Simon, whose work I have known, but not for a while, and Anthony Byrne, whose work I know less of, thought were a match for any of the great partnerships I've seen in the past, really. And then in Julius Caesar, I was captivated by the partnership of Cassius and Brutus, which was Alex Waldman and Martin Hudson. And I thought they were a great sort of double act as well, really. So I enjoyed the season overall. I enjoyed some more than others, but I'm glad I went to all four because I think it was great to be immersed in that whole period together. I thought it was a great idea, and I was very glad I participated in it in that way. Particularly glad of adding in the Imperium plays because I think that I really did feel as if I was kind of learning and comparing, and it was a feast really when I put all of that together to what must have been about 20 hours or so of playing time. So an enjoyable experience.
Is it Cicero the one who said it's all they say of him in Julius Caesar? He said something in Greek, but it was all Greek to me.
That's right.
That's where you get the expression. But I think I particularly liked the Julius Caesar and the Antony and Cleopatra, although I had to say I was slightly disappointed that they didn't have, you know, the same people playing the repeating roles. I mean, especially Octavian and Mark Antony. But I suppose because they are smaller parts in Julius Caesar, you might not want your big guns to play it, and you might want sort of a much more major actor like Anthony Byrne. I mean, he's not massively well known, but he's been at the RSC now for at least a decade, and I think he does really excellent work in what he does, but perhaps not that well known as an actor outside his work at the RSC. I was, you know, slightly disappointed because I do like this whole idea of Octavian, who becomes the Emperor Augustus, and he becomes the emperor at a really young age, and he sort of becomes the top man at a very young age. And I always remember the first time I saw Antony and Cleopatra years ago, they did it with a very young group, and the group he had around him in Antony and Cleopatra, sort of this group of, includes Agrippa, who was his right-hand man, and I think Marcellus is another one of them. Those three people, they did them as sort of almost young gangsters, which I felt was a really good way of playing it. And it wasn't that much emphasized in this one, but it is that kind of thing where you have this very young man. I mean, we go back to the Godfather, perhaps. We have the very young man who has to take on the mantle of being the head of the big family, which is, I always remember that, and I always think of Antony and Cleopatra with a lot of affection for that. And in this, I mean, Joseph Simon, I don't think I've seen her for quite some time. The first thing I saw her in on stage, I mean, I'm a science fiction buff, so I'd seen her in Blake 7, but the first time I saw her on stage, I think, was when she did After the Fall, where she plays a character normally played as if she's Marilyn Monroe, because it's Arthur Miller musing on life and his relationship with a young singer who everyone takes to be Marilyn Monroe. But of course, when Joseph Simon played it, it felt a lot more like Billie Holiday, and she really made that play excellent. I remember the person sitting next to me, who was actually a Hollywood actor, his reaction at the end of the play was just to say wow, which is pretty good. So she's a very impressive presence, and it's good to see them together. I didn't think Coriolanus really felt the same as all the others, and Titus Andronicus, of course, that much further away and that much bloodier, they felt kind of outliers, but Coriolanus especially, that definitely felt like an outlier, and possibly because they weren't using the same people, they weren't using the same, you've got a lot of the cast repeating with only one or two of the major roles sort of coming in and doing almost guest spots. You do get some slight confusion with actors playing major roles in some parts and then sort of almost being background characters or playing minor roles in others, which, you know, is good for within this ensemble, but you lose something by not sometimes having interesting connections between some of the major parts and trying to bring out the sort of the connections between the plays. They felt very much unrelated, although the Antony Cleopatra and Julius Caesar did work quite well together. But overall, I think it's an impressive thing. I'm looking forward to Imperium. I'm gradually reading my way through the Robert Harris books on which they're based. So it could be a rather interesting study if and when they come into London. Hopefully they will. But I did find that some of one of the problems with the RSC things is that they don't feel quite as fresh once they've been doing them in Stratford. I've been finding that, you know, something being done in Stratford, everybody raves about it, and then it sort of comes into London a year or 2 years later, and it doesn't quite feel as fresh as it could do. I think these Roman plays are originating in London and then going up to Stratford, or most of them are. So they're going to get it the other way around, but it's a slightly faster turnover, I think, than RSC coming in.
I think the key issue with Imperium is going to be where they put it if they bring it to London, because there is nowhere like the Swan in London that the RSC do and can use, really. And I do think it benefits greatly from the more intimate space that you have in the Swan Theatre in Stratford. I mean, it wouldn't for me work anywhere near as well on the Barbican stage, for example. I mean, I think that the Coriolanus, for me, I mean, it's always difficult to do crowd scenes and battles on stage anyway to make them believable. But I think in Coriolanus, I mean, I thought that the crowd scenes and the tribunal scenes in this kind of first part just didn't have any passion. They just really lacked passion. And then the later scenes, you know, which are more intimate scenes, when you got Coriolanus offering himself to the enemy and his mother pleading for him, I mean, they were really well handled. But I think it was the big crowd scenes. And in Titus and Julius Caesar, I mean, I was sitting very closely to the stage, and they were both very bloody plays, which is the plays. But when you're close up with murders and stabbings and things, they're not as believable. And there was only one scene in both of those plays where the audience gasped at the horror, and that was the demise of poor young Flavius, which didn't require any stage blood. So I think that they're different for those kind of reasons, really.
We're now going to talk about The Twilight Zone at the Almeida Theatre. This is a play by Annie Washburn, and she has adapted stories from the TV series Twilight Zone, and the stories are by Rod Serling, Charles Beaumont, and Richard Matheson. She tells about four or five major stories, but then there are other stories sort of mixed in, sort of slightly shorter ones, and I think there's even one which is never even mentioned. I kept seeing a man dressed up as an alien, and we never really got any comeback on that one. It really depends on how much people remember The Twilight Zone, because I don't think it's been shown on television for quite some years, although they have, because they shot it on film, they are able to bring out some very nice Blu-rays of the series if you want them, so you can see them in actually much better detail than they would have been seen on television at the time or ever since. The stories aren't all that familiar. I think the only story I was really familiar with was a story about a young woman who is going through constant plastic surgery to make her beautiful, and when they take the bandages off, she appears to be a very beautiful young woman, except all the people around her look like pig people, and that's kind of the joke of the story, because the idea is you see them all in masks. And this is in some ways how they tell one or two of the stories. They're getting to the punchlines first. I mean, on that one, you don't need an awful lot of build-up, you just need a few scenes coming in, and then you kind of get the punchline. But they go into detail on one or two of the stories. The cast for this includes Oliver Alvin Wilson, Frank Ashman, Adriana Bertola, Lizzie Connolly, Amy Griffiths, Neil Haig, Cosmo Jarvis, John Marquez, Matthew Needham, and Sam Swainsbury. They're all playing multiple different parts, telling the stories, and as I said, the stories are sort of broken up and interspersed between each other, so you don't really get a complete idea. And I think maybe on the night I went, some people felt a little bit confused by it. You couldn't help feeling there was a slight uneasiness with the audience. Things were getting broken up, and they were getting a bit confused about exactly where they were. The set, which is by Paul Steinberg, is a sort of as if you're in the inside of a television, but they also have a main idea of a diner. It's very 50s or 60s, this chrome diner counter that they bring in for, certainly for the first story, and then for one or two other places when they need something like a bar. There's also one or two magic tricks that they do. Sometimes they work, and I went fairly early, so perhaps they haven't quite got the magic right. And when you've seen something like Harry Potter, where they really get the magic effects right, they didn't always get them right, and I think they needed a magician to come in. I should say that the director here, Richard Jones, I think he's put a decent team together, and it does work as a play. I mean, although, as I said, they're all interspersed, all the stories are sort of broken up and interspersed, and Anne Washburn has given us this tale. She previously did Mr. Burns at the Almeida Theatre, which I think most people didn't really get on with because it became very odd towards the end, but it kind of worked. I think this kind of works. There is a sort of kind of a running joke where the character playing Rod Serling comes on and begins the talk in the way that Rod Serling introduced the Twilight Zone. You ideas of sort of, we're now going down a path which takes us to the Twilight Zone. And you keep getting that joke. It never plays off until towards the end, where they actually mention the word Twilight Zone. And you also get this idea of it sort of quoting itself, and you suddenly have the character Rod Serling, and it's as if he's on a television set. But I thought it worked reasonably well, and it was a reasonably good idea of the Twilight Zone. I do like this television series quite a lot, and I enjoyed it. But I did get the feeling that other people weren't into it as much as I was. What did you think about it, Gareth?
Well, for some reason I was expecting a play, so the first surprise for me was that it wasn't a play. And as it was the Almeida's sort of seasonal offering, I called it a selection box. And as you say, I mean, its story is taken from 8 episodes of the show over a period of 5 years in a kind of mashup. And the first thing that irritated me about it was the interweaving, because the stories are not, it's not sort of just one story followed by another story followed by another story. As you say, there's an interweaving between them, and I found that a bit irritating. But then you kind of do eventually go with it. I mean, it just irritates you at the beginning, I suppose, because you're not sure what's happening. Well, it irritated me anyway, because you're not sure what's happening here. Hang on a minute, have we finished that story then? And you're not sure what's going on. It only jarred once for me, and that was there was a scene of racism amongst neighbours during an alien invasion, which I really didn't understand why they put that in at all, because I think to a modern audience it was just offensive. I appreciate that it would have been more genuine perhaps in the 60s, and perhaps, you know, even sort of, you know, something that would have been plausible. But for me it just jarred in this production in 2017, really. I think Richard Jones is the right man for this kind of material, because he does have a kind of quirkiness about the way he puts on theatre which works with this. It's actually quite tongue-in-cheek. So, you know, quite a lot of the time you're smiling at it. Sometimes it's actually very funny. And overall, it's got an incredible feel of nostalgia, even though The Twilight Zone wasn't really part of my youth. It did make me feel nostalgic. I mean, I was aware of it and I had seen some episodes, but, it wasn't something that was part of my youth in the way that other TV things perhaps might have been, really. I like the whole design concept of it. I thought the whole 50s and 60s style, you know, very monochrome in design, based on just a palette of black and grey and silver, and just a little bit of touch of blue. I loved the fact that the giant TV, the walls of it are sort of covered in stars, and when people come on with props, they're actually in a kind of camouflage that matches the walls, which I thought was a really lovely little touch. And certainly the night I went, I thought the illusions were great. So Richard Wiseman and Will Houston's illusions worked perfectly well the night I went. And I thought they were perhaps not as good as Harry Potter, but they were very good. There's a very good soundtrack. I mean, I think the sort of very authentic Twilight Zone soundtrack, although a modern one by Sarah Anglis, I thought added something as well to the whole thing. And the performance styles were, I think, you know, they were kind of pitched combination of retro and mystery and B-movie and comic book. And I liked that. I just liked the performance styles that went with the stories, really. So actually, you know, despite the fact it wasn't what I was expecting in some ways, I actually enjoyed the evening. And, you know, I thought it was very enjoyable. But I think that you shouldn't go expecting a play, because it isn't a play. You know, it's another description I made of it was kind of flicking through the Twilight Zone annual, but live, because that's the sort of feel it had, really. But I was very glad I went to see it, and I think there was a lot of quality about the production.
One thing I will add, Matthew Needham seems to be the go-to actor at the Almeida. Two productions in 2017, this and The Treatment. And he's shortly to be appearing, I think, in Summer and Smoke, also at the Almeida, so they seem to like him there. We're now going to talk about The Grinning Man at the Trafalgar Studios. This is an adaptation of the Victor Hugo novel L'Homme qui Rit, The Man Who Laughs, directed here by Tom Morris, with Nihai writer Carl Gross, and with some music and songs by Tim Phillips and Mark Tickler. It is, as they say, a magical reimagining of this classic novel. Paul, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
I didn't see the version of it when it was at the Bristol Old Vic, I believe. But actually, I saw this at Trafalgar Studios, and I really liked it. I think there's something about this show that sets this tone from the minute you walk into the theatre, which actually, if you look at people, what people have been tweeting as they go into the auditorium of the main Trafalgar Studios, you know, you see this giant grinning face with teeth, and it's like you're about to see some sort of freak show at a carnival. And in some ways you are, actually, because what this show really attempts to do is to give you a bit of a show with music rather than a typical musical. And it's been interesting because I saw it before Christmas and I was thinking, well, it's an alternative to Panto, that for those that don't like that at the silly end of the season. But now this show is being extended, so obviously word of mouth is sort of getting out there that this is something intriguing and interesting. I think it's quite faithful to the novel, actually, that Victor Hugo wrote, in so much as I can gather, in that it follows the story of this man who enchants the court with his strange look. And over the course of the show, you actually find out the backstory about why this happens and so forth. But actually, it's really the telling the story that actually is quite intriguing, because actually it's introduced by a court jester who sings this very dark song, "Laughter is the Best Medicine." And it was having, I know the critics actually drew parallels to Shockhead Peter, but actually I was also thinking the Tom Waits musical, The Black Rider, was also in my mind watching this. But actually what they used, pretty much every theatrical trick in the book to tell the story, there's waves gushing with, you know, giant devices and things like that. But there's also these puppets, which also are telling the young story of Grimpain. Holding it all together is Louis Mascal, who's the hero of the piece in The Disfigured Boy. He's on stage most of the time, and while I felt he was somewhat constrained by the prosthetic disfigurement that he had to wear, you know, he's quite, you know, the future leading man, I think, for the more interesting shows out there. I think there's also Julian Bleach as the sort of the bitter, nasty court jester, is quite hilarious too, and he actually keeps this show quite dark but humorous as well. And I think, you know, ultimately they've got something quite interesting here. I think perhaps the tone isn't quite right yet, but actually for a new musical that hopefully will still be reviewed and revised, because perhaps it's a little bit too long as well as being odd with its shifts in tone, I think, you know, it's got an interesting future and, you know, hopefully a promising one ahead of it. Gareth, what did you think?
I liked it very much. I think enjoy probably isn't the right word, because it's quite scary at times. But no, I was really glad I went to see it. I've nicknamed it The Hunchback's Lesser Known Brother, because Victor Hugo, of course, also wrote The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And I mean, it's quite interesting, because I actually knew nothing about the book or the story. And when I was reading up about it, I discovered that it's actually been adapted as a film 6 times. And it's been adapted for the stage 4 times, and 2 of those has been as a musical. So it's quite a sort of, it's been around, as it were, but perhaps not in my time scale. So this was first I really knew of the story, which I think is a bit convoluted, to be honest. I think the story is a bit convoluted. And I think that Grouse has done a good job of creating a sort of clear narrative, a shorter, clearer narrative, although I think I'm with you that it could do with just a little bit more trimming, really. I do think there are similarities with Shockheaded Peter, but I think the similarities are more to do with the musical style, which I think is very much the Tiger Lily's kind of sound, I think. The look of it is the thing I think I admire most about it, because John Bowser has transformed the Trafalgar Studio One and with this kind of gothic design, and then Gene Chan has added in costumes, and overall those design components just give it a great look, a very original and very exciting look, really. There is a use of puppetry, and I thought particularly effective on this occasion, and Finn Caldwell and Toby Olley's puppetry includes a wolf, who is a sort of pet for a character called Ursus. And I thought this was amazing, because actually the actor seems to be part of the animal. So the kind of puppet and actor kind of morphed together to create this wolf, which I thought was quite extraordinary, really. Louis Pascal, I think, you know, a tough job, really, to act when you never see his face. But I think he does very well. And I think he sings very well, as we've seen in other shows. And I think she's a Dutch actress, Saan den Besten, who plays this very fragile, blind character, Dia. I thought was really terrific. I really liked the way she characterized that particular role, really. So I thought it was, you know, when we talked about everybody's Jamie, I've forgotten what the rest of the title is now, but when we talked about that, we talked about it being a breath of fresh air for the West End. And I think this is another breath of fresh air for the West End. And judging by the extension, it appears to be finding its audience. And I think that's great news. So very welcome transfer from Bristol, I think. And I hope it does well.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azeta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.